So welcome, everybody, to the first week of session 9. Our focus is going to be space. So we spent the last two sessions on time. We're going to spend the next two sessions on space, and then the final two sessions on knowledge. And as I said in the orientation, it's kind of remarkable that we can now actually be at a point where we say, gee, I can see where this course is going to come to an end, because it seems like it's been ongoing. I hope to everybody's enjoyment and benefit. In the orientation, I reminded you again about the retreat, so I won't say any more about that. Let me say one general thing about what I expect us to be doing today, and then we'll go into it. The general point is just that we are, in this week, we're reading from the TSK book, and we're kind of jumping in chapter 4. Of course, we've read maybe most of the material before that, I'm not sure. And then starting next week, we will mostly be reading our way through Dynamics of Time and Space. And so that raised in my mind a question that I've reflected on a little bit in the class, and certainly I think people generally have a question about it or have views about it. And that is, what is the relationship between the first book, the TSK book, and the later books? There is something written about that. There's actually a rather extensive section at the end of When It Rains about the different books and how they connect with each other, or really the focus is a little more on the different qualities of each one. But this question comes up there. I don't want to talk about it right now, but we'll get to it in just a few minutes when we, as we start to work our way through this material. But let me just pose the issue. So there's old timers in TSK, right? And some of you are old timers. And by old timer, basically at this point, I mean someone who got involved with TSK when there was only the TSK book. So in the first decade of the availability of the TSK vision. And many of the people who had their start with the first TSK book, you know, have the view that that's TSK. You know, everything else is commentary. And I think that's fine. That's a very reasonable approach. And I want to talk a little later about you know, why that makes some sense. In my case, I'm an old timer. I started back then. But I also had the rather unusual experience of working with Rinpoche on all of the later books in the series. And so I'm very engaged with those books. They're in my heart. And so I probably see it a little bit differently. I don't think that there's a right answer to that question. People will respond differently. But I want to say something about it as we get a little farther into it, because in effect what's happening is we're looking at the first TSK book today and its approach, and then starting next week, we shift over to Dynamics, and we don't go back, I don't think, to the first TSK book. So it seems like a good opportunity to discuss it. Okay, we'll get to that not too long, in the not too distant future in this phone call. Let's go to the beginning of the reading. We're in chapter 4 of the TSK book, right? And there is a reason for starting in chapter 4, and again, I'm going to use a teaser here. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But we'll start talking about it now. So Rinpoche starts at the beginning of chapter 4. He refers back to the mind. So chapter 4 is about the world, about, you could say, physical reality. Let's see what the title of the chapter is. The world and other bases, or something like that. Let me look.
That's right.
Yeah, the world and other bases. Thank you. Okay. So he's talking about the physical world, but the previous chapter, he talked about the mind. And at the very beginning of this chapter, he says, mind is not so difficult to work with, to challenge philosophically. I'm pretty sure that what he means by that is you can really question even the existence of the mind. There are mental events, but is there this overarching or surrounding entity called the mind? You can question that. And there's a good summary statement of that question on page 47, which is really the anticipation of chapter 3, which starts on 49. On 47, he says, and this is a very well-known statement to many of you, he says, mind, like space, has no foundation. It is not a palpable or solid thing, and it does not do anything. Rather, the mind is a sign of a specific focal setting being taken on great space. And surely we've talked about that at some point in the course of these sessions. We're not really going to talk about that point because here we're distinguishing mind from space. But he starts off by saying, okay, we have already challenged the mind, at least philosophically. He goes on to say, challenging it experientially, well, that's another matter. But at least starting to see how you can question the mind, that's less difficult. But challenging the body, which is where he wants to go in the reading that we're doing today, that's more difficult. And it's very interesting, actually, to see the structure of the presentation in TSK, in the space section. If you go back and look at the table of contents, chapter 1 is the presence of space. And that's really introducing the fact or introducing the notion that we could really engage space, and it offers ways of doing that, mainly through the giant body exercises, right? And then chapter 2 is about the body. So it's inviting us to find space in the body. Chapter 3 goes on to the mind. Chapter 4 is about the world, and that's what we're looking at now. And chapter 5 is sort of pulls it all together. It's called Being in the World, Being Space and Time. So it's transcending all of those structures that we've explored in chapters 1 to 4. And that, in fact, is one of the things that's characteristic about the TSK book, which kind of sets it apart, which is it's got this very, very carefully developed structure. Proceeds step by step. It takes apart this idea, then it goes on to that one, building on what's already been done and anticipating what's going to come. That's one of the characteristics of the first TSK book that makes it really very wonderful. So what we're seeing here is that you start by looking at the mind, or you start earlier, but then you've moved on, and you're looking at the mind, and you realize that mind is in some sense insubstantial, or you could say mental events are insubstantial. And we are actually very used to that in this culture. Maybe that's kind of clear in other cultures, it's hard for me to say. But in this culture, we're so used to the creations of the mind, the activity of the mind, the way that the mind can change, the way that we're not in control of our mind. These are all ideas that are very, very familiar to us. So we think of the mind as something that can be challenged. Maybe not on the level that TSK challenges it, but still there's an openness there. But when it comes to the body or to the world, it's harder. And the reason that it's harder is very straightforward, I think, and that is that we accept the solidity of what appears in the world. Or another way of saying that is we make this division into the subjective and the objective realms. The subjective realm depends on me and my experience, but the objective realm has nothing to do with me. It's more fundamental, it's a better way to say it. It's more fundamental than I am. So if I disappeared from the face of the earth at this very moment, that would just be a little blip in objective reality. You know, the objective world would go on. That's the way that we're used to thinking about the objective world. So if you want to challenge the objective world and you want to say that it's constituted in some sense by space, it's inherently much more provocative or challenging or paradoxical to make that kind of claim. Of course, there are other issues in working with space on the mental level, because our usual understanding of space doesn't include the mental. You know, we usually think of space as just physical. So that's a whole other issue, but that's been dealt with elsewhere, and we're not going to really talk about that today. So the idea is that you challenge the mental realm, and of course there have been a lot of exercises in the TSK book on this point. Mostly they are about thoughts, right, and the space between thoughts and the beginning and ending of thoughts. And you know, you really look carefully at the mental realm and you begin to see that it's not constituted, it's not solid in the way that we usually think. So that is a preliminary step. I mean, it's deeply, deeply important, but it's a presupposition or a prerequisite for starting to look at physical entities, which somehow claim to be solid, claim to be real, and therefore make it difficult to investigate them on in terms of the TSK vision. Of course, the answer to that, we're not going to. Well, in a sense, that's what this chapter is about. The response to that is to say that the very idea that there is a substantial world that exists independent of each of us, or of my subjective experience, let's say, that very idea is in fact just an idea. It's just a construct. It's a way that we have of making sense of the fact that we experience a world that seems to be independent of us, and a world in which we can hypothesize that if we disappeared, the world would continue on. And it's a very, it seems like an extremely realistic theory or hypothesis or explanation for what the world is like, but it is only a theory or hypothesis or explanation. From a TSK perspective, we always start with our own experience. Of course, we also go on to question experience, but we always start with the world as we experience it, because that is the foundation. That's where we have to start. And so for that reason, you know, for those of you who are interested in connections with Western thought, I've always felt that the philosophical movement dating back to the early 20th century called phenomenology is a very good place to make connections with TSK, because phenomenology says the same thing. It says don't talk to me about solid substance apart from my experience. The place that we always have to start our inquiry is with our own experience. And we've looked at that. We've talked about that occasionally. I would actually like to have us practice with that idea. This is a practice. It's basically, you could say it's exercise 7 from the TSK book, which was the practice that was assigned for this week, the body-mind-thought interplay. But now we want to do it from a particular perspective, or with a particular kind of vision guiding us. And the vision here is this vision that what is fundamental is always what we experience. It's always the world as it appears to us. And so what that means, and we will look at this after we practice, we'll look at the discussion, but just to anticipate a little bit, what it means is that the way that we split the world up, typically, the way that our culture splits the world up, typically, into the subjective realm and the objective realm, which seems extremely obvious to us, you know, that's a good way to make sense or to structure reality, that is less fundamental, or a better way to say it, that is an explanation that we offer, or a model that we put into place, or a way of seeing, that rests on this more fundamental point that whatever we experience is experience. You know? And there's no reaching through or getting behind what we experience to some other realm. And this is a point that Western philosophy is happy to explore, and has been explored for several centuries now. But of course, we want to engage it in a more experiential way. So the practice is simply to let experience arise, and do this with the eyes open and the senses engaged. But it doesn't matter whether the experience has to do with the mental realm of thoughts and memories and feelings and so on, or with the perceptual realm, let's say, of the senses. In either case, and this is really fundamental to understand this, and I'm sure everybody is basically in tune with this now, in either case, whether it's the world that we experience through the senses or the world that we experience mentally without relying on the physical senses, in either case, what is there in that interplay of body and mind and thought is always an experience or an arising that integrates our perception of the world with the world. You can't really separate those two out. That's the claim, and what we would like to do, what we can practice with now for a few minutes, is just to engage the world in that way, with that vision or that way of seeing foremost in our mind, so that what we're doing by allowing that kind of experience to arise is challenging, really, the split into the subjective and the objective realm. So, let's do it. Okay. We'll do it for about 5 minutes or so. Okay, so let's come back together. And I invite you, as always, to share your experience or observations or reflections.
Jack?
Yes.
Jack, there was this quality of knowing the experience of me knowing.
Okay. Do you want to say, so I'm not positive people can hear that. I assume most people can, but actually I don't see why not. But just in case, I'm going to repeat that. So Hayward is saying there was an experience of me knowing. Is that, did I say that right?
Knowing the experience of me knowing.
Okay, knowing the
experience. Recognizing that all experience was a consequence of knowing.
Okay.
Knowing experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, which has really important consequences, of course, for the role of knowledge. And one of the characteristics of the TSK vision is that knowledge is not separate from what appears in space. Knowledge is not separate from what happens in time. There's always the knowing component. And to have the direct sense of that being so, I think, is a really important part of what the TSK vision is trying to engage. You want to give a specific example, Hayward? Or does that make sense?
First there was I was sitting here having the experience of knowing the room, and then the recognition that I was knowing of that that too was an experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Too was an experience. That there was always the knowing of the experience, and then fill in the blank on what the experience is.
Okay.
The experience becomes content.
Right. So it doesn't really matter so much what the content of your experience is, when the focus that you're describing is really central. It just counts as content. But there is the experience of knowing whatever the content is. And that's, you know, when the moment you're there, you've really already completely, I think, undermined the division into subject and object. Okay. So we're waiting for any comments, if people have them in the chat box. While we're doing that, here comes something from Ileana. Okay, go there. So it seems to me that when comments, this is Ileana, it seems to me that when comments and discursive thoughts arise, the aliveness of experience fades. When the mind is open and free of thoughts, it is possible to be more connected to what arises. Okay, well, this is a point that comes up in meditative traditions as well. It seems really central, that thoughts have a way of taking us away from experience, comments and discursive thoughts. Now, especially in light of what Hayward was saying, it seems as though it wouldn't have to be that way. But it is. I'm not saying that, you know, that's not accurate, what you're describing, Ileana. But in principle, if there was the experience of you commenting, or the experience of thinking discursive thoughts without much concern for the content of those thoughts, then that experience, in principle, should be just as alive as any other kind of experience. And if that's not true, and I think that in the in the course of the next session, as we look into dynamics of time and space, we'll have a chance to look more carefully at why that might not be true, or why it seems to be that that's not usually true, because of the way we structure and pattern things. But you know, if it's not true, it really has to do with a certain orientation that we have, and it's an orientation that's very difficult to dismiss. And it's interesting because you know, we started off today by saying, well, physical space or the physical world, that's the one that's really hard to challenge because it seems so totally solid. But if you come at it from the other side, you could say our engaging the world of thoughts and concepts as being unreal or less real, that's also extremely difficult to challenge. And again, it has to do with the fact that when you accept the reality of the objective world, you accept the reality of the subjective world. And the subjective reality that we're willing to allow ourselves ordinarily, at least in the realm of thoughts, is the echo of our experience. Rinpoche says that somewhere. Maybe it was in the last session, but the thought pops into my mind now. He says experience arises as the echo of itself. That's how we usually engage things, and that unreal quality, I think that's what you're pointing to, Eliana. Okay, David is now writing about the windblown palm tree, and I was going to say, that's not how I think of where you live, David, with palm trees waving, but I see that he's now somewhere else. Okay, looking at the windblown palm tree, silhouetted by clouds, and the greenish-blue color of the Gulf of Mexico, feeling the split of me as an observer of the scene as I felt my body, then dropping the positioning and just being clouds drifting and palm leaves moving. So this is very much in the same vein as what we've already been looking at. You know, I think we're familiar with the TSK vision as a group now, to the point where we really can see how our usual structures, which are the observer structures, the discursive thinker structures, the one who is the bystander to the experience instead of being in the experience as the one who's having it. That's, I'm trying to rephrase Hayward's point there. All of those usual structures, it's possible to let go of those. And there is discussion in this chapter about the bystander, outside stander distinction, which is another very central way of talking about that. So then you find yourself much more involved, much more engaged. And one way to say that, or one way to experience that, I should say, is this very nice description that David has, dropping the positioning, just being the clouds drifting and the palm leaves moving. And yet, of course, at the same time, the palm leaves move in a frame of seeing that is established by the position that you have as you look out on those palm leaves, right? It's not a contradiction. It's just another element. Okay, Ken writes, subjective experience of me as close at hand, seems highly excited and mutable, whereas the outside standing world is much more being as there and relatively constant. Yeah, that's right, and it seems to me. And I think it's an aspect of what Rinpoche is pointing to when he says it's very difficult to challenge the world, because the world, I've been saying, it seems so solid, it seems as though it continues to exist whether I'm there or not, and in fact that is absolutely true from a certain, given certain assumptions. That world is substantial, but it is also... can we say it doesn't yield to the dynamic of time in the same way? In other words, you have the palm leaves blowing in the wind, and so there's movement, but the palm tree is there, darn it. It's much more, to use Ken's words here, it's relatively constant. So those are all some of the things that we just constantly want to be investigating. And you know, that kind of ongoing investigation, that's what the TSK vision is about. Sudhi says, what Hayward shared is what in mindfulness is called stillness of the awareness and the movement of the mind happening at the same time. Okay, stillness and movement happening at the same time. That seems like a very good formulation, absolutely. You know, we're always looking for ways to describe what it is that we're engaging, and the descriptions always fall short, or, you know, they always say too much, and they never say enough. They can point us. They can, and that's, of course, the issue in TSK and in meditative traditions. You know, you say, well, descriptions always are inadequate to the task, and yet you keep on trying to describe. You know, books keep getting written. In our cynical age, we might say, well, people write books because they have to generate some income, but that's just in our capitalist society, let's say. But even in earlier times when people didn't write books to get rich, maybe to get famous a little bit, but they still wrote books. They still felt the need to explain things, to point us, you know, to point us in the right direction. I just noticed there's an academic who writes some very good material, a fellow named Jay Garfield, and he wrote a book called, I don't remember the exact title, but it was based on this image we all know about the finger pointing at the moon. And I just noticed the other day that he's now writing another book called The Moon Points Back. And I don't know what the book is about, but I kind of like it. You know, it's suggesting a different alternative there. Okay, and Michael writes, it seems that the image of myself observing. Okay, so there is an image of the self observing. That's good to notice. Is just as tenacious as anything I can posit as existing outside myself. Yeah. As long as I'm concerned with my reputation, my happiness, and my survival, the world is a construct of convenience, of little importance apart from my investment in what I perceive I might be offered. In other words, what's in it for me, right? What can I get out of it? And we kind of touched on that just a couple of minutes ago. On the one hand, Rinpoche says, okay, the solidity and stability of the world, the constancy of the world, as Ken said, that makes it very difficult to challenge that. But on another level, as we were saying, the difficulty also arises from our commitment to the positions that we have. As you say, the image you have that I'm the one that's observing, and the concerns that you have with reputation and the like. Now, again, in principle, it might not have to be that way. So I'm going to give an example that came up for me when we were doing the practice just now. I looked in front of me and I saw these flowers. They're actually artificial flowers. But they're on a table on the other side of my desk. And seeing the flowers, I had the thought, essentially, I can use those. Because just the other day I was thinking, oh, it'd be nice to have some artificial flowers in this other place, and I hadn't seen these for a while. So that's the kind of thing, excuse me, that's the kind of thing that Michael is pointing towards. We're concerned with, you know, what's in it for me, what am I being offered here? But if we experience the reactivity of the mind that says, I can use those, if we experience that itself as experience, without identifying with it, it's a kind of a subtle balance, without identifying with it, then it may not have to have this sort of ghostly quality, the opposite of what Eliana was talking about, it's as David said, it's dropping the positioning. Now, if you drop the positioning, are you still going to have those same thoughts? Am I still going to react to the, you know, seeing those flowers in terms of, oh, that's something useful? Well, maybe that begins to fade away. Maybe that's not the heart of the experience. And I begin to realize that much more important is appreciating the flowers. These are artificial flowers, but they're very pretty. So what about just appreciating the loveliness of the flowers? So Ken writes here, how can I use this to establish my appearance? I'm not sure what the this is, Ken. Can you say a little more? How can I use this to establish my appearance? I'm going to leap ahead a little on that while Ken maybe explains a little, but that is the point, isn't it? That we're usually trying to establish the experience. Okay, Ken says, this is anything that attracts me. Right. So if I understand you correctly, and this is where I was starting to go, Ken, that's kind of the question we're asking, or I think I'm beginning to understand. You're kind of rephrasing what Michael said, right? Whatever comes up, whatever draws my attention or attracts me, I always engage it in terms of the question, how does this support me? How does it establish my appearance? How does it establish the world? How does it fulfill my concerns? We are very aggressive consumers of the world that we encounter, you know. We do not have the kind of objectivity. Yeah, Ken, I guess I got right what Ken was saying. Rinpoche says sometimes we need to learn to be objective. And it's always interesting because sometimes we think of objectivity as meaning this kind of scientific, detached view, more like a bystander, let's say. But that's not at all what he means, and that's clear in the context when he brings it up usually. Objectivity has to do with letting go of this this attitude of aggressive consumption or of asking what's in it for me. So there we are. That's our kind of favorite posture, you could say. That is to say, our default posture, the one we always go into. Caroline asks, does appearance here, and here maybe means in Ken's comment, also mean existence, identity, reality? So Ken says, how can I use this? This is the question we're asking. As I said, this is our default posture. How can I use this, whatever this is, to establish my appearance? And Caroline says, well, you mean by appearance, you probably also mean to establish my existence, to establish my identity, to establish my reality. And I would think that those are all included in what Ken says. But if we've got it wrong, Ken, you can illuminate it. Okay, good. Well, we have enough time to go a little farther, which is good, because I'd like to go a little farther into the chapter. We've already talked a lot in the comments. So Ken agrees. I'm going to leave it at that. We've already talked quite a bit about this split into subjective and objective, which is where the chapter goes, and it's relying here on the idea which is brought up in the mind chapter of recognizing that there's no source from, which is a way of challenging identity, really, or existence, you could say. Things show up, and we assume that our job is to determine the source of what shows up. So the mind is the source of thoughts, or matter is the source of the universe, or maybe we say God is the source of the world. We're always looking in that way, and what this chapter says, and it's drawing on material that was, you know, on an approach that was developed in the chapter on mind, is that there's no source from. And this is where the chapter talks about bystanders and outside standards. That's the way it it kind of plays itself out because that's the way we structure things. But the underlying sense is the no source front. So we challenge the whole idea of causality. We say that nothing has ever been set up, and I'm kind of paraphrasing some of the discussion in the early pages of the reading. And when you do that, you arrive at great space. That is to say, if your challenge is successful, well, successful is never the best word, but if the challenge bears fruit in a kind of TSK sense, it's, maybe that's an all right way to say it, then you know, you drop the search for a source, for something that is more fundamental than our experience, you could say, and you arrive at great space. And so on page 75, the second paragraph there, he says, everywhere and at every level of analysis that we look in this world, we can find an infinity of detail and extent, but it draws us on rather than giving us fulfillment in the moment. We get caught up in the content of what appears. Here has a different meaning within this world of an infinite content, you could say. Here has a different meaning within this world than it does from the great space perspective. And so the availability and primary grounding character of great space becomes a mystery, a tantalizing puzzle. And then he goes on to say, great space is the closest and most important, and yet, for ordinary perspectives, the most inaccessible and irrelevant of all aspects of life. This is a really interesting and important statement because it helps show why the vision is really so important, and at the same time it helps show why it's difficult to communicate the vision, because it seems, this possibility seems so remote. This possibility of engaging great space. And even if it seemed like, you know, a nice idea, it also seems wholly inaccessible. So that's what he's pointing towards here. Now, that leads me to the point that I mentioned I was going to discuss, just briefly. The difference in approach between the first TSK book and the later books. And it's hard to generalize about all the other books, but I've already said one thing, which is that the first TSK book is structured very, very carefully, you know, step by step by step. You unlock access to this new vision of reality. But it's all done in terms of eventually, or at, you know, as the journey unfolds, and then in the end you realize, you know, it wasn't really a journey, there's nowhere to go. But eventually, as long as you're thinking in terms of a journey, you arrive at great space, great time, great knowledge. That way of approaching the vision, the great space, and you know, sometimes we talk about the third level, the great space, great time, great knowledge, that doesn't figure as prominently in the later books. And there are books where it just doesn't get discussed at all. In Dynamics, I don't think there's any discussion in terms of great space, great time, or great knowledge. Although I could be wrong. I didn't really check that carefully. In Level of Knowledge, you don't see that so much. In Sacred Dimensions, it's there. It's not the focus in the same way. In the first book, that path from ordinary understanding to great space, great time, great knowledge. That's what the book is about, really. And that's less true, considerably less true, for the later books. Now, I don't mean to say that Rinpoche changed his mind in the later books. And in fact, if you take a look at When It Rains, you will find whole sections that analyze each of the books in terms of the three levels of time and space and knowledge. And that way of analyzing is in there because Rinpoche wanted it to be there. He wanted me to be sure that was central or presented in a clear way. But it's not part of the later book. So you know, why isn't it, if what I'm saying is accurate? Why is that difference there? And I think there's two things I want to say. I don't think I'm going to exhaust the topic here, but let me say these two things, and then we'll stop for today. One is that, and it's related to what I've already said about the first book, there's this tremendous rigor in the first book. It requires this commitment. It's like saying, okay, I am going to become a student of the TSK vision, and maybe I'm overstating it now, but I'm going to devote years of my life to doing that, and every year I'm going to go on retreat 3 or 4 times a year. This is some of what's described in the first book, and I'm going to do these practices again and again and again, and when it comes time to do one practice, I'll start by reviewing all the other practices. It's this almost a vocation, you know, being a TSK student. And that's difficult. And I don't think that, not many people have taken that on. Now, some of you who are on this phone call have really been very serious students of the TSK vision and maybe approached that. But I think that there was a kind of recognition. I think Rinpoche began to realize that, well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but let's say Rinpoche at least wanted to allow for the possibility that there were ways of exploring TSK where you didn't have to do it with that kind of intense commitment. I think that in order to go deeply into TSK, you need a full commitment. But you know, more and more, this is my sense, and maybe this is just my own limitation to see it this way, but more and more there's a sense that the commitment can be a part of your everyday ordinary experience. And that's where I think the later books go. Sacred Dimensions may be a little bit of an exception, I'm not sure. And each book is different, so it's very hard to generalize. But that's one thing, and I think that's probably the fundamental thing. I will say that there's a second aspect which Rinpoche points to here and there in later on. When you talk about great space and great time and great knowledge, there is a tendency to turn those into the goal. You know? And at that point, TSK is in danger of becoming what Rinpoche is always warning against. It's in danger of becoming a belief system. You know? So you say, you know, we have to transcend ordinary space and time and knowledge and enter the realm of great space, great time, great knowledge. There's nothing inherent about that way of saying it that's problematic, but somehow all those capital letters, you know, start to make it seem like you're a TSK pa, as we sometimes say, using the Tibetan phrasing. You know, it's like, you know, well, you're a Buddhist,
making
and
making a thing out of time, space.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've been trying to avoid the term hypostasize, but that's exactly what it means. It means making a thing out of, making a thing or a goal out of the TSK vision. And I think that is a potential danger. And one of the things about the later books that I think is you know, really stands in contrast in some ways to the first book, and I love it, but of course I've invested a large part of my life in these later books. So, but one of the things that stands in contrast is that they're just full of approaches and possibilities, and you know, the word multidimensionality, which gets used in DTS, is a word that for me is very meaningful in terms of the TSK vision. It's just the opposite of saying, okay, let's start at the beginning and step by step we will unfold this path. It's saying, well, try this, you know, or you know, like that, try this, you know, something like that. In I've been working with the interview that Rinpoche does in Dimensions of Thought. It was written in 1980, called Ocean of Knowledge. And toward the end of that, he says something like, it's not so essential, he says, that you be, you know, that you have to sort of absorb the vision as a whole. If there's some little part that speaks to you, then that's your starting point. And I think that that's, the later books are kind of based on that, whereas the former book, the first book is more like, this is it, this is the root text. And that root text slash commentary approach, that's another way of approaching it, and that's fine. And I'm not in any way trying to say that that's a problem. I'm just trying to point to the distinction or difference between the two. Okay, so I kept you a little late. I'm not too surprised. I see a couple of other comments here, and I'll just at least mention, well, actually there's one comment split up. Michael writes, Descartes' maxim, I think, therefore I am, can be deconstructed. I know, therefore I am. I know, and I am, knowing and being. And that, you have now just raised a huge topic, which maybe we won't talk about right now, but the relationship between knowing and being is tremendously central in the TSK vision. Okay, so let's stop there for today.